Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is best-selling author, journalist, and public speaker, Susanna Cahalan. And we're talking about her new book, The Acid Queen, The Psychedelic Life and Counterculture Rebellion of Rosemary Woodruff Leary. Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is best-selling author, journalist, and public speaker, Susanna Cahalan. And we're talking about her new book, which is an amazing history and biography, The Acid Queen, The Psychedelic Life and Counterculture Rebellion of Rosemary Woodruff Leary. Susanna, welcome to the show.
So wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
What brought you to write this book? You're not a person of this era. What attracted you to her, to Rosemary?
You know, it started with the kind of interest in general in altered states. My first book, which was called Brain on Fire, it was a memoir, was about my experience with a kind of prolonged altered states caused by an encephalitis, so something that I had no control over. But it really taught me about the kind of frailty of the mind, how our brain-mind creates reality. Fascinating stuff. And I continued that interest in my second book, which is The Great Pretender, and that's about the history of psychiatric diagnosis, the limits of medicine. And so psychedelics are in the culture now in a very new and exciting way. And I thought, I'm interested in this. And that led me to being interested in Timothy Leary, the high priest of acid from the era, and made me aware of a woman who basically was erased from history called Rosemary Woodruff Leary, who was his third or fourth wife, depending on who you ask and at what time.
It's an amazing story because not only is it the biography of her, but it's a history of that era and different aspects of that era, including the really rampant sexism that went on. And that's why she was barely remembered today.
Totally. You know, and it was kind of an interesting, you know, as you said before, you know, I'm not of the era. So it was exciting in a way. I've been obsessed with the era. I think that time in history is so exciting and fraught and such a big part of the culture today. And so it was so fun to get this opportunity to go and reexamine that era, that time, through the lens of a woman who is not known, who was not the kind of big, you know, marquee names of the time. And so you're putting the camera, you know, on a person who's just at the edge of the frame, and that takes in new information and allows a kind of new story to be told about a time that has been well trod.
How did you gather this information? Because you have an awful lot of very personal information in this book.
I do. I was so lucky. I'm an archive lover. I love an archive. And I was lucky enough to, at the time, I was a scholar at the New York Public Library, and they have these kind of wonderful situations where you get access to their collections and you have a room of your own. And I first became aware of the Timothy Leary archive there, and then became aware that there was this other collection of the Rosemary Woodruff Leary collection, and it was a much smaller collection. It was only about 20 banker's boxes versus 400 in the Timothy Leary collection. But I went through that, and I had never heard of her before, but I found this fascinating, complicated, incredible woman who really didn't even have a Wikipedia page. And in there, there were her diaries, there was an unpublished book, there were her tax returns. I mean, it was a real full-dimensional archive, and I was very lucky to have access to it.
When I finished the book, I ended up being much more interested in her than Timothy.
Thank you.
Well, the reason is that she's a much more nuanced and complex person. And truth be told, she really was the person who made it possible for him to be such a magician in the public's eye. I mean, she was sitting on the bed there with him all the time, helping him edit his lectures, his books, and stuff like that. She was really holding it together. And that wasn't just true of her, by the way, as it comes out in your book. There were many women who basically kept the stuff running while the men went out and sort of tripped their asses off.
Yes, and peacocked, essentially.
That's not a term that was used then.
Yes, you know, I love that you say that. That means so much to me because I had the same experience. You know, I went into this kind of being interested in Timothy Leary. I wasn't a Learyite. I wasn't a Leary fan, but I was interested in him. And he's an interesting story, you know, coming from Harvard, being this high priest of the era, huge person. But you're right, I felt the same way. And it was so interesting because at various points in putting this together, I came across people who had wanted to do this Rosemary story, or, you know, maybe wanted to do a movie or something. And they were like, well, I don't see her as the heroine, as the hero of this. And I had the exact opposite. I had no problem seeing her as the hero. He was so much more complicated in terms of, I didn't find him heroic. I found hers, even though she is complicated too, I found her story ultimately extremely heroic. And she was filled with a lot of integrity and courage, and but also complicated.
Well, and I have to say that the whole extended where she broke him out of jail scene and then over to Algeria, which we'll talk about hopefully if we have time, that's very cinematic. That's got to be made into a movie at some point, because that was unbelievable. Let's talk about her as a young child first. I love the way you describe her, because it's, you know, this person's going to be interesting when they grow up, as a rambunctious and willful child.
She was. I mean, she came out, you know, she was born in 1935, which is so important to, you know, remind people the context, right, for women of the era. But 1935 in St. Louis, her father worked on the railroad. But, you know, even back then, you know, her father worked as a magician, kind of as a hobby, and she would go with him to these bars as he did these sleight of hand tricks, and she would tap dance on the bar. You know, like, amazing origin story for this woman that I would find to be far more complicated as I learn more.
She also had her first sort of, I guess you would describe it as a psychedelic experience as a child.
Not
taking acid or anything like that, but she had a sort of a very interesting consciousness experience.
Absolutely. A mystical experience. You know, she was 8 years old. And this is really interesting, because I did some work just kind of, you know, there's so much that you go rabbit hole down when you're writing a book that doesn't make it in. But a lot of people who become religious figures, shamans, et cetera, later in life, they tend to have these experiences as children. And she did. It felt like the world was like plugged into an electrical grid. That's how she described it in her diary, in her unpublished book. And so it's like this oneness experience, a spontaneous mystical experience. And apparently it's kind of common for children. And some people just forget about it or don't really find it that profound ultimately when they get older. But for Rosemary, that was a key moment in her life.
Now, we can't go into her entire pre-Leary history, but it is very interesting. She was a stewardess. She made an appearance in a film. She hung out with the Beats. For a period of time, she was with Bat Matthews, a jazz person. And that was just amazing. People like Herbie Hancock and Carmen McRae would actually hang out in her apartment.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Miles Davis was a
fan. You imagine that?
That's what's so fun about this story, which was, it just was like, you know, the kind of cliche of an onion, but that's what she was. You peel back, and then all of a sudden she's hanging out with Jack Kerouac at a bar.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing to me. And it was so fun because I actually found people from that era, which, you know, that part of her life had never been told before. So it was just, oh my gosh. I mean, even her pre-Leary life to me could have been a book.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Now, from the very beginning, the I Ching was always a resource for her to go to, and it became especially true when she hooked up with Leary. And she's always had that side of her person, which was mystical and sort of organized like the I Ching is.
Yes, that's beautiful. Yeah, it's like a seeker. Always seeking knowledge. And, you know, it was partially from this idea that she felt that she was kind of part of history, that there was this path for her, that, you know, like thinking of herself as a great person. But also, you know, in terms of greatness as that big idea. But also there is this, you know, she really used these as tools, and she felt that they were windows into another way of being, another realm. And I think it started when she was 8, just as you picked up on. And the I Ching was, I think I now use the I Ching because of her. Do you? Do you use it?
I used to. I was more of a Tarot person.
Oh, I'm a Tarot person too.
I have stories I could tell you.
Oh, I can't wait. I want to hear.
Not in this interview. This book is also a fascinating history for people who don't know about the rise of LSD, lysergic acid diethylamide. What people might not remember, I remember this. It was originally legal.
Yeah.
And
it's kind of like what is happening now. It's trying to, it's almost like it's returning to the 1950s, where it was used as a therapeutic modality. I mean, it initially was used as a way to understand mental illness, because they thought, oh, this mimics psychosis. But then it started being used in therapy, which is what's going on now. It's kind of interesting.
And Timothy Leary was, as you mentioned, was a professor at Harvard. He was a psychologist. He wrote a very important textbook, Diagnosis of Personality. And then there were three people, Richard Alpert, who later became Baba Ram Dass, Ralph Metzger, and him. They started the Harvard Psilocybin Project. And we can't get into all the details there, but eventually they're let go from Harvard. And a lot happens. How did Rosemary and Timothy first meet?
Well, they met at an art gallery opening, and they had a brief run-in where she visited this experimental commune in upstate New York called the Hitchcock Estate in Millbrook.
Yeah, who was Peggy? Who was Peggy Hitchcock? Because she's an important figure throughout the book.
Oh, Peggy unfortunately passed away last year. She's basically an oil heiress, huge amounts, you know, old moneyed family. And she was someone who was a kind of benefactor. People called her the connector. She was a patroness of a lot of jazz musicians and artists, and even, you know, work being done in academics. And she ended up undertaking a psilocybin trip after having a very bad breakup with one of Rosemary's exes.
Uh-oh.
And that, like, blew her mind and really helped her heal. And so she became a big advocate for the use of psychedelics. And she briefly dated Timothy Leary, but also helped fund his operation, and eventually helped him land at the Millbrook Estate, which was owned by her brothers. So she's a hugely important
figure. So Rosemary and Timothy are at this art gallery.
Yes.
And the thing about Rosemary is, and I guess we should talk about, she was devastatingly good looking.
Yes, absolutely. It's a huge part of it. I mean, listen, she knew how to use it too. It wasn't just the good looks. It was like, she knew how to put them to good use.
So Timothy sees her, and obviously he falls for it, because he's sort of a cad.
Yes.
Not sort of a cad. He is the dictionary definition of a cad.
He's like a cad, but who also is like a serial monogamist. I don't know if you know of men like that. But I know those types.
Yeah.
And you know, he needed one solid woman by his side to ground him for various probably reasons we could go into, you know, analyze him. But he needed a solid force of a woman by his side. And He saw Rosemary, didn't initially realize that she'd be that much of a grounding force, which she was, but he fell for her, and she was carrying a book by Wittgenstein,
right?
A very out there philosopher, very intellectual. And he said, I think he had a line like, you know, if the feds knew my type, they got it hook, line, and sinker. Like, she was almost like central casting for someone he'd be into.
Yeah, I know that ploy of carrying a really interesting book.
Yeah, we all know that. We've all done that.
For me back then, I'm not going to talk about it. But let's get, there's so much stuff in this book. I just want to talk about a couple of general things. Let's talk about Millbrook. What was it and where was it?
Yeah, so, you know, it was an experimental commune. It was an experiment in a new way of living, using acid really as the foundational kind of, you know, substance that undergirded it. But basically, they were trying out all these new things. Vegetarianism, sure. Communal child rearing. You know, they were doing some kind of open, free love kind of experiments. But it was all kind of done. Some of it was Eastern religion. Some of it was using the kind of new age psychology that was becoming big, the human potential movement of the time. And then it was experimenting with, like, ritualized use of psychedelics as well. So it was a real... It wasn't even bucolic. I mean, it's a grand setting of this estate, this millionaire at the time. Now, well, it would have to be a billionaire's estate. And that's where they were having this kind of trying to launch this new way of living. So it's a pretty amazing time in history.
And Rosemary and Timothy end up there and sort of spending a lot of time there. Now, that's another whole story recounted in this book. Is a sort of evolution and eventual really bizarre decline that occurred at Millbrook, where it just sort of turned into like this sort of disgusting version of hippiedom.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it starts with idealism.
Yeah.
And I mean, they genuinely believe that. And I do believe that. I don't think it was a cynical place at all. I really don't.
Well, it didn't start that way.
No.
But then eventually it just sort of decayed.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the utopia turns to a dystopia, you know, or like even not even a dystopia, but like the worst reflections of the culture of the time, you know, just depravity and even just like the returning to the gender norms of the worst types of gender norms of the time. You know, the women are always the ones cleaning the dishes and making sure the house is clean and taking care of everyone who's cracking around them. The children, unfortunately, there's, you know, there was interesting. I did interview some kids who had a fantastic time there.
They
it was
did.
Like summer camp, you know, they were like on their own doing it. But I also, there were also children who were dosed with, you know, acid against their knowledge and then against their will. You know, there was some stuff that I don't even know that happened there that was probably pretty damaging and dark. I mean, it was a kind of a time, it had two faces. And, you know, like many things that try to kind of push the envelope that far, you kind of do get that dual experience where some people have these transformative, if you talk to some people who visited, they are such reverence for the place, but some people who live there have some horror stories to tell too.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is bestselling author, journalist, and public speaker, Susanna Gahalen. And we're talking about her book. It is a story and a half. The Acid Queen, The Psychedelic Life and Counterculture Rebellion of Rosemary Woodruff Leary. How would you describe their early part of their relationship? What was she to him and what was he to her?
So interesting. You know, I think to him in the early parts of the relationship, she was, you know, beautiful. She was someone who propped him up in the, you know, publicly. You know, like being with her made him seem even more appealing. But I think internally, not even just into the public eye, she was someone who had a lot of authenticity. She lived a lot of lives before she met him. And, you know, he came from academia. He had the tweeds. He came from Harvard.
Right. He came from a different era than her.
Exactly. He was born 15 years earlier. He was born in 1920. So she really connected him with that youth culture. She gave him a sense of authenticity, of coolness, of being plugged in. And conversely for her, you know, she was someone who was limited in her options. She had aged out of her job as a stewardess. She had, by 30, they kicked to the curb, which is just amazing. And she was fleeing an abusive relationship, another abusive relationship, two-time divorcee. And here's this man who she really considered to be a great man. And he really, to her, it was like, he allowed her to kind of exhibit her own greatness through him in a way.
And is that the evolution of that relationship of how she viewed him is one of the great arcs in this book. Because eventually, I don't want to give away too much in the book because she comes back. But Timothy, as you mentioned, Timothy's of a different era. Ultimately, what he wanted was a traditional marriage with kids.
Yeah, I mean, that's what he pushed this whole time with her. He would, you know, she had a great line. She said he was the kind of man who put out his hand and expected someone to put a martini in it.
Yep.
You know, you can imagine that type. And she was actually very happy to provide that in a way, I think maybe superficially, but I think she wanted to provide that to him. She wanted to support him, but she couldn't give him ultimately what he envisioned for them. And honestly, what the kind of ideal of the ultimate or the kind of femininity or the yin to yang kind of relationship, which was to give him children, and she couldn't have children. So there became a flaw in their kind of persona, in the kind of image of Tim and Rosemary being representative of that divine feminine and masculine power.
He just didn't seem to come to the fore when she was in trouble. For instance, she went to jail and was incarcerated. And, you know, he sent her a copy of Lord of the Rings. And she's licking every page because she thinks he did something to put acid in the page to help her out. But he didn't even do that.
How dare he?
Well, no, seriously. I mean, when it comes to her needs, he always seemed to fall down on it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, deeply, 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 deeply. And in that beginning era, he didn't really appreciate her. I think after they get married, you know, there's a change in terms of his respect for her and the media really embracing her. But before then, he really didn't. I mean, you're right. She went to prison for him because there was a grand jury hearing trying to bring charges against him. And she refused to cooperate. She was in contempt of court. I mean, this was for him, for his cause, for his mission, for his safety, you know. And ultimately, you know, he lets her down again and again and again in the course of their relationship. That is very true. Yeah.
The cast of characters in the wings in this book are just incredible. G. Gordon Liddy.
Yeah.
is like a major character.
Wild.
Yeah, but you're not old enough to remember Nixon, but man, what a slime ball.
I mean, yeah, it's amazing to me. When I saw
He was one of the Nixon plumbers, right?
Yeah, he was one of the Nixon plumbers. And so before he became one of the plumbers, before he went to D.C., he was in Millbrook. He was in Poughkeepsie in particular, and he was in the DA. He was a DA in Poughkeepsie. And he headed up this charge in the community because they want this Millbrook, New York, if people who don't know, very beautiful, tony, like bucolic, community, tight-knit, lots of vast, enormous estates, but also normal people as well, combination of those things. And they didn't want Leary and company. At first they thought, oh, Harvard professor, we're fine. And then all sorts of freaks and, you know, and dropouts and hippies started to come and descend on their community. And there were stories of wild sex parties. And there's, you know, a all women's school right down the road. You know, there was a lot of worry about that, mostly about the sex more than the drugs, interestingly. But they wanted him out. And so G. Gordon Liddy, one of Nixon's plumbers later, was the one who was heading up this operation to get Leary out of Millbrook. Wild.
Now, another theme in your book, and I find this, and I was alive to actually sort of see this, is the split that happened in the counterculture in the late 60s and the early 70s between the psychedelics, the people who were into the Leary sort of ideas, and then the political arm of people like the Weather Underground, the SDS and stuff like that. And that comes to a fore. She breaks him out of jail, and that's a whole story. People read the book.
Yeah.
They abscond to Algeria and ended up living with Eldridge Cleaver in the Black Panthers for a while. And that's a whole scary story about that.
Oh, wild.
But it really brings to the forefront of what was happening. The political counterculture really didn't think an awful lot of Timothy Leary at all.
No. You know, first of all, he was older. You know, he was a generation older than they were. He was a kind of a father figure to some who really believed in him, but a lot of people just saw him as out of touch. And, you know, he at the time when, you know, in the kind of mid-60s, mid to late 60s, he was not advocating for politics at all. In fact, he thought politics were part of game playing.
Right.
He said the only time you should talk about politics is when you're on all fours. You know, he had all sorts of lines about, you know, the kind of joke and the trap of political theater. And so he was advocating, you know, a lot of these young men who were of draft age, he was telling them to drop out, which was putting them in some danger. So he was really out of touch in that time, at least according to the kind of the political left of that time. But when he was imprisoned, however, because he became a political prisoner, I mean, it was very clear, 30 years in prison for some marijuana really was it was extreme.
Yeah.
And so once that happened, you had people like the Weather Underground, you had people like the Black Panthers, the Yippies, getting behind Leary as a kind of political figure, a martyr, if you will.
But still, I mean, Abbie Hoffman once, during one of his stage presentations, he actually got up and said, you're creating a group of blissed out, you know, ripe for annihilation. I mean, I mean, there was a lot of bad feeling between the political left and the sort of psychedelic left.
They were completely at odds.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't really be advocating for civil rights change, just for example, if you were high all the time. You know, and like this idea of transforming the psyches of Americans through psychedelics, you know, Leary really championed that. He said that psychedelics could cure racism. It could cure warmongering.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of like the psychedelics could just be this panacea for the culture felt ridiculous as people were, you know, looking around their community, seeing them broken and seeing all sorts of their friends being drafted off to war in a far-flung place. And, you know, so it was just, it seems like Leary was a joke. And in many ways he was at that time, especially.
It's interesting. There was a big event and people who were alive at the time will remember it. There was the human bee in January 14th, 1967 in San Francisco. And Leary was there being Leary, but it was interesting that Rosemary didn't attend.
I thought that was fascinating. So that's the time when, you know, he had said his famous mantra, turn on, tune in, drop out.
Yeah.
He had said that a few times. He said it in a Playboy interview. He had said it, you know, in writing. But this was the first time it really resonated in the culture when he was, you know, on this massive stage in Golden Gate Park and, you know, says this huge, you know, this statement that would resonate across the culture. And Rosemary decided not to go that day. She was, at this point, Leary's fame had hit another level, and he was really, I would say fame had turned to notoriety. And she had really seen up close what that was like, what it was like to be in the public eye, to be known in that way. And she found it repulsive. She found it disgusting. And at various points, she really had to pull herself back and kind of get herself out of that scene because it was too much. And it was really interesting for someone who kind of saw herself as this great figure in history. When she got close to what that really was like, what fame is really like, it was gross, you know?
Yeah, she really felt like as he proselytized later on, that it was just all BS. That he was just controlling people and throwing stuff out there. They separated for a while. And then the amazing thing is they got back together because Leary was dying of prostate cancer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
she really took care of him is what it was.
Yes, no, she really believed that, you know, she kept saying things like, and I made it to him. Yeah. She would say that a lot. I made it to him. Like, she took that vow far seriously than most people do, and maybe too seriously. Depending on who you ask, but maybe if you ask me, I would say maybe too seriously. But she said, you know, this was her role. It was taking care of him. And she felt that even when at times he didn't deserve it,
yep,
she had made that promise to him. And she had this idea of who he could be at his best. And she really believed in the power of that. I truly believe that. She did believe that he had the potential to be a great person. And, you know, he didn't necessarily follow that all the time. But she believed that he could be.
And
she
saw his passing. And she lived on for a while. And she became an even more interesting person after Timothy Leary, but those are tales for other times, and you need to read the book. So, this is one of those books you really need to read it.
Thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for that. Thank you.
My guest tonight is best-selling author, journalist, and public speaker Susanna Cahalan, and we've been talking about her book, The Acid Queen: The Psychedelic Life and Counterculture Rebellion of Rosemary Woodruff Leary. Susanna, it's been a pleasure.
It's been an absolute delight. Thank you so much for really getting the book. I just can't thank you enough.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.